You can interact with us so many ways. Go to www.emsgarage.com. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com. Go to our Twitter account, @emsgarage. Or you can download us on iTunes. Just search EMS Garage. You can also call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's your weekly podcast about EMS news and events and all things in between. I'm your host, Chris Montera, and we're just happy to have you along for this great ride that we sometimes think of as EMS. Joining me this week is Gary Wingrove from Washington, D.C. Hello, sir.
Good evening.
Good evening. And your flight was good, I take it? Or did you fly out today?
Yeah, it was early up. 3:30 this morning.
Ooh, that's really terrible. Well, did you have to be there for a meeting? That's really terrible.
Yeah, it started at noon.
Oh, okay. Right on. Well, cool. Well, I'm glad you came on. I'm glad you got a nap and room service, and you can settle down, and we can talk about some pretty funny topics this week, I think. Also joining us tonight is the second time he's been on the podcast, Mr. Kyle Bates. Hello, sir.
Good. Hey, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good. And you're in Buffalo, New York, right?
Buffalo, New York, underwater right about now.
So tell us what's going on. Are you floating away?
We got hit with a lot of storms the last couple of days. We have towns being floated away. We've got trailer homes being wiped out and flooded. It's been quite a weekend.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm so glad you're still around and you're not floating and you haven't been flooded out in your house. That's a good thing.
I'm on a hill.
Oh, that's even better. I was following Buck Ferris's Twitter this week, and they had some really wicked storms in Kentucky, and just complete, I mean, every time I saw his Twitter, he was moving patients between hospitals, and they were actually getting really bad flooding, so I hope it's not that bad up there.
Not too much here. It's more of our southern tier area, but it's like our county and such, so.
It could be worse, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, you know, tonight we're just the intimate podcast of the three of us, but the show must go on, as they say. And so tonight I really wanted to talk about a couple stories that have been in the news of late, and one from the medic blog 999.wordpress.com, and that's our good friend Mr. Mark Glencourse. And he said tonight he cannot make the podcast because he's going to be, it's 3 a.m. his time when we record. So he said he has to get up in the morning and take care of some kids. And probably wouldn't be best to be up at 3 a.m. when he wants to take care of them. But on his blog this week, they talked about DNRs. And if it's really, sometimes it seems like in our profession that when you go on scene and somebody has a DNR, and you just kind of have to sit on your hands because you know they're dying, and it's really it's kind of a hard reality. And I wanted to get your guys' opinion on that, and I know Gary had some opinions because he himself has something, but Gary, I'll let you describe it, and then we'll go from there. Do you have a DNR, is that right, Gary?
I do, actually. In Minnesota, I think a fair number of states have this provision. We have a law that allows for what's known as a living will. And a living will affords you the opportunity to name someone to be your, to make decisions for you if you become incapacitated, and also to specify what you want done and don't want done. And so I have a living will. I've had it since the day the law passed in Minnesota. I used to do lots of nursing home runs, and so I thought about this topic a lot, and didn't want to end up like some of the people that I transported. So I have a living will. It's got a DNR order in it. It only goes into effect if I become incapacitated, can't make decisions for myself. But I think that on this particular topic, it's something we don't deal with a ton, some of us more than others. But when you get into hospice and whatnot, you know, you're into a kind of a different territory. And people don't make a DNR order on a whim. It doesn't work that way. Generally, you're deemed terminal for some specific reason or cause. And when you make your DNR order, it's really about that specific cause. For some people that end up in a hospice situation, it may be a little bit more broad. But I think we do a bit of a disservice to the patients that we transport by not understanding that process a little bit better, taking the time to figure out exactly what condition that they're DNR for, and trying to care for them. So I read Mark's blog post, and they had an interesting situation over there. I described it as, I think in my reply to him, as a couple of bodily functions that happened simultaneously that really had nothing to do with whatever was wrong with him. It couldn't have. Essentially, the guy that he wrote about vomited and took a deep breath at the same time, and so had some issues with his lungs. I don't think that guy probably anticipated that event happening when he just...
You cut out there, Gary. You don't think he anticipated?
Decided to have a. I don't think the guy, when he decided to have a DNR order, anticipated that those two events might occur simultaneously, where his lungs might fill up with fluid that he was vomiting, so I don't think the DNR that he had really covered that situation and the resulting pneumonia or whatever that was the cause. Probably should have been treated.
Well, yeah, I did read that too, and I thought that was... It's tough. Well...
It is hard. And it is a hard living case wills. Living wills are tough, too. I recognize that. It's tough for paramedics because my document is probably 7 pages long and covers a lot of scenarios, and you pretty much have to read it and then try to interpret what I said when I wrote it. And that's tough to do in the case of an emergency. If you get somewhere, though, and somebody's heart stopped, you know, that's a different circumstance to me than if you get somewhere, like the case of this guy that was in the nursing home and having trouble breathing because of what happened to him. They had some time. And, if that guy had had a living will instead of a... This is a complicated subject. Our states have dealt with it in different ways. Some states have forms, some states have armbands, like a medical bracelet. Some of the states have tried to define what workers are supposed to do. Each case is a little bit unique, and this is an area we're probably destined to struggle with for some time.
Well, I agree, and I think that you're right, because I do believe you kind of faded out there, but I think we got it, and I'll be able to enhance that. But yeah, I do believe that the states have dealt with it. I know in our state, you can get a bracelet or a necklace and put it on. It says DNR. Now that doesn't necessarily impact what that DNR says, and you should find the paperwork. But I look back and I think about vomitus and things like that, and I don't know that you can describe every scenario. But I do like what you said, though, is if my heart stopped, don't do anything. If I'm having trouble breathing, do things that are within reasonable scope to protect my airway and try and save my life. I guess there's varying degrees of DNR. And Kyle, what do you think?
I think, you know, the problem that arises is a DNR is exactly that, a do not resuscitate, which means if I have cardio or pulmonary arrest, we're done. Up until that time, you treat what you need. You're not, you know, and it may prevent it. And I think Gary brought up a good point, you know, about the other issue. You kind of faded in and out a little bit, but about, you know, how somebody, you know, how a patient had a condition that would kill them if not treated. And I think that's the one thing that we run into is people look at, oh, well, he's a DNR. I don't need to, you know, do XYZ treatment for them. Now, I'm not saying to intubate them and start cardiopulmonary resuscitation on that, but if you got a person with a DNR, he's unconscious and his blood sugar is 23, you need to treat that. That's not how I want to go. A lot of states do not, I know I've worked in about three or four different states, and they don't allow us to honor living wills. I don't know how it is in your states.
Oh, well, we're allowed to with a call to the doc. You can go, hey, here's the situation. And in those situations, I mean, it's very situation dependent. And you know what? I'd much rather err on the side of treating the person than not. And go, you know, I know that the gentleman had a living will or whatever the case may be, but I felt it was in his best interest to treat him. And, you know, especially in this case where the guy had vomitus, you know, a little bit of suction, maybe that would have done the trick and he'd have been on for another 10 years. I don't know. I mean, we can't say for sure.
New York State actually came up with a, because we actually have a pre-hospital DNR, which we can honor, but they just came out with a new program called the MOLST form, M-O-L-S-T, and it stands for Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. Hmm. And it's the only document that is recognized in hospital, nursing home, pre-hospital. It's the only blanket form. And it's a hot, bright pink. It goes on the refrigerator. It's designed by a physician. And it's supposed to be for end-of-life issues. It's 4 pages. It gets into exactly what the patient wants, DNR, DNI, you know, what treatments they want. Do they want non-invasive positive pressure ventilation, such as CPAP or BiPAP? Do they want intubation or not intubation? If they want intubation, you know, I only want 3 days of trial intubation, you know, on a vent to see if that works. It's that specific. And it's probably one of the best forms out there. The website, if anyone's interested, is compassionandsupport.org. It's a New York State program, but it's something that we're just starting to launch now. And I know I've run into a lot of families with folks. It's really meant for like the last year of life, where we've run into a lot of patients that are in that time. And we're starting to educate more and more families to this program.
Well, you know, my dad had something like that before he had his terminal illness, and it was comforting in the time that we needed to make the decisions, because he had said, you know, I only want the vent for 7 days. If it doesn't look like, you know, I'm going to be able to come out of this, you know, terminate all life support, things like that. So it was so those kind of orders, I think, are very nice for the family, but it's really hard at the time of a 911 incident to go, okay, let me flip through these real quick. And boy, you know, it's almost better sometimes to treat what you can and transport if you can, because it's just so, sometimes that's just such a hard call on the scene.
Well, this form is actually made for that. It's check boxes. It's very brief. It's very quick. And it's something that you have to have a little bit of a familiarization before you come into it, but every form is the same. It's just which boxes are checked, which boxes are not checked.
Wow, that's really nice.
And it's actually put together in order of critical treatment versus non-critical treatment.
Now, Gary, you travel around a lot. Have you heard of this in other states, too?
Well, what you've both described is really what the living will is. I did mine immediately when the law was passed in Minnesota. I know a few years later they came out with a form. Sounds a lot like what Kyle was talking about. I didn't switch mine over to the form, but it's those kinds of things that you put in.
So, Gary, since you travel a lot, how do you think you'll be protected if something happens while you're on the road?
That's a good question. My living will doesn't travel with me. It's at home and at the hospital that I go to and my clinic. No one's going to have access to that until some contact is made for medical records.
So if something happened while you were on the road, you would basically just get transported to the hospital, and then once your family arrived, they could help make those decisions based on that living will? Or is it state-specific? So your living will is only valid in Minnesota. I mean, is that true, or is it, or does it travel with you as long as somebody is there to execute it?
My guess is, I don't know the answer to that question specifically, but my guess is it's a legal document that was made in the state where I live, and it probably carries weight in any state that I travel to once it arrives.
Because it is an executed legal document, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
It's a, there's a durable power of attorney for the people that I've named to make decisions for me. It'd be like a contract. I would think it would be considered sort of a contract.
Okay, very nice. Any more thoughts on that subject?
I think it's a difficult issue that's been plaguing EMS for years, you know, and I think it comes down to it, like I said earlier, it's a little bit of a misnomer, DNR, you know. So I'll say, ooh, do not rush, you know, I mean, by any means, do not resuscitate, you know. You do everything up to the point of, you know, they stop breathing or their heart stops. But, you know, I agree with you. You know, I've been handed, you know, living wills and such, which we're not allowed to honor. But, you know, I'm picking up the phone real quickly and calling the physicians. I've yet to have a physician tell me no.
Okay.
I would just add in that this is an area where we need some debate. It would be good to have some debate. It crops up in areas where there's been a problem. And it gets some local debate, but it'd be good for us to continue this debate. Just kind of echo what Kyle said. Nobody wants to be in pain. The guy that Mark had in his blog post, that guy didn't choose to choke to death, which is basically what was happening to him. And those kinds of things, in the absence of cardiac or pulmonary arrest, those are the sorts of things we have to sort out in a short period of time, and if we think of the person we're treating as ourselves or one of our family members, we'll go a lot further in making decisions.
I completely agree with that, because I think that, like I said, even in our case, it was really nice and comforting to have that at that time. So you're right, and you really need to think about what's going on with that person at the time of the denial or the withdrawal of life support, and go, you know, is this something that they can recover from? Is it a really bad trauma that, you know, that they're going to be able to overcome? Is it a heart attack that now they just need a few days of ventilatory support to turn the corner? There's so many things and so many variables and scenarios. I think it's up to the family to know what your wishes are, and vice versa. These are discussions that everybody should have with their loved ones and their family members as well. So
the physician who came up with the Moles form, she was talking, is that every Thanksgiving they had what was known as the death talk, and they sat around and all they talked about their wishes.
Wow, that's a really good idea. Although, could you think of a better day like Halloween? I mean, really, that would be the Day of the Dead, you know, or, you know, November 1st, really, is the day you should be doing it.
That's the cranberry sauce. Don't innovate me.
Yeah.
But only innovate me if...
Yeah. If your food kills me, I start choking.
That's right. Oh, that's good. Well, you know, I'm so glad that we got to talk about that tonight. And I hope maybe we'll bring this up again when Mark can come on and really talk maybe about what goes on in the UK. Because I'd like to get an international perspective on this. Because... not only because a lot of this we deal with U.S. law, but I'm sure that around the world it's a little bit different. So thank you guys. Are either of you going to EMS Expo this year?
I'm not, unfortunately.
No.
I am.
You are?
I am.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you guys that we're going to be at EMS Expo. So if you want to come down there and join us for a podcast, you want to come watch how a podcast is made, you want to be on our videos because we're going to have some videos posted, come to the EMS Expo and find us right there on the show floor. We'll be right next to the Cygnus Media booth, and we'll have a place for everybody to sit down and watch the makings of a podcast, if you will. So join us October 26th through the 30th. We'll be live on the show floor most of those days. And pretty soon on the website, we'll post every day all the days and times that we're going to be hosting podcasts. I know Jamie Davis is going to do a medic cast, probably two or three of them. I'm going to be doing a leadership and an Educast or two, as well as probably two or three EMS garages. So it'll be a lot of fun, and we're going to get some audience participation, which I can't wait for. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. So come down and join us. We thank EMS Expo and Cygnus for their support and wanting to take us out there to be a part of that show. And I'm really excited to be. I last year was my second expo, in Vegas, and I loved it. I thought, oh, I like it in Vegas a lot. I mean, Vegas is just a great town anyway, so who wouldn't want it in Vegas, right? But this year's is in Atlanta, so come down and join us there. Let me change my... Okay. Boy, I can't talk tonight. I've had coffee. I should have...
Have a beer.
I know. I need to have more beer just so I can smooth out my syllables. So along the same lines, that's what I was really trying to say, as the DNR, I found an article this week on emsresponder.com talking about mistaken CPR pronouncements. And it's actually an interesting tale of a gentleman that was in Northwest Baltimore. He was shot. He was a burglary suspect, shot in the head with a .40 caliber pistol by the police department. Shot in the head by a .40 caliber pistol by the police department. The EMS crew arrived and mistakenly pronounced him dead. 30 minutes goes by. Police officers either see some movement or see him breathing, and they call the EMS crew back, and now he's in critical condition in a Baltimore hospital. Has that ever happened to either of you?
I hope I never had. I haven't heard of it yet lately, so.
Gary, how about you?
No.
Yeah. In fact, I was talking before the show. I said, you know, that is the one thing that I'm always really afraid of, is calling somebody dead when they're not. I'm super paranoid about it. Because I don't want my name to show up. Go ahead.
And well, you should be.
Well, it's just like, I guess it's the one thing that we should know how to do, is tell when somebody's alive. And, you know, I know that there are times when pulses are really weak, or, you know, breathing's very shallow, but we have other tools in our trade other tools in the toolbox, if you will, to ensure that people are alive. Kyle, you've heard of that or no?
Yeah, actually, I have heard of it. It's unfortunately, I don't think it's all that uncommon. I'm looking at several articles now. One I pulled up back in 08, where I believe it was in Texas. Basically, in Texas, they pronounced a woman, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes with my fingers right now, dead on scene from a motor vehicle crash. And they came to find out that she was still alive. I mean, they even covered her up with the yellow tarp and everything. And the medical examiner found her to be still alive.
Yeah, that crew got disciplined, by the way.
Did they?
Yeah. Oh, that was a bit... In fact, we talked about that when it happened, and it was kind of the same vein of this conversation. But, you know, it's like, boy, we as EMS providers really need to know when somebody's not alive. And we talked about maybe how that scene went and things like that. But boy, you're right. It's just a scary thing. And I think you're right. It probably happens. Unfortunately, we don't document it in our industry, but boy, it should be as reportable as a near miss in the FAA or as a plane crash in the FAA. I mean, it should be something that we investigate and try and figure out why that happens in our industry and limit the times that it does, or actually eliminate the times that it does, because it shouldn't happen.
I think, you know, people look at injuries and go, oh, he can't live through that. And that's one of the hard parts that we're running into. And there's an article in GEMS just recently called Proof of Life. And they really looked into that. And it was actually, I think, this month or last month's looking at the aspect. And they say, you know, that essentially, you know, no one's dead until you're wired and dead. I think they're going to have to start looking at that as well.
Well, that's the standard in our service, is you have to run a 3-lead EKG. All three should show that there are no indications of a viable rhythm, which is generally asystole.
Now, but if you read the article, they actually said that to keep, you know, because of the Lazarus phenomena, where people come back from the dead, to actually have a patient on the monitor for 10 minutes post-arrest.
Whoa.
Yeah, there's actually been documentation of patients regaining, you know, heartbeat 7 minutes after the last drug was given.
Wow. That's impressive. That's kind of scary, too.
It's going to be a lot of paper.
That's a lot of paper. I mean, well, hopefully with new modern techniques, we could just let it be on and then upload it to our EPCR, and hopefully it would stay in there instead of running all that paper, because you're right, that is a lot of paper.
I'm wondering, though, because I've been thinking about that, about, you know, 10 minutes. You know, you should have the patient, one protocol is you have the patient on the monitor for 10 minutes post-resuscitation. Well, my question arises, what happens at the 10-minute part where they start getting a pulse back? Or they start getting a rhythm back? Now, you went 10 minutes without any CPR on that. Are we now opening ourselves up to liability for non-feasance?
That's a very good point. I don't know. I don't have an attorney on tonight, so no idea. I would guess so. But then there's also the other side of it too that says, what are we saving after 10 minutes of no oxygenated tissue or no oxygenated blood to the brain? I mean, really?
Oh, I agree with you, and that's where I'm wondering, because I saw that. But it's like, okay, so do we just start, you know, we get rid of the whole calling them in the field and transport everybody to the hospital? Which I don't necessarily agree with, but, you know, where are we coming into?
Gary, what do you think?
Well, I think we overdo medical direction in a lot of aspects in our industry, but this is one area where my personal choice would be a requirement for medical direction. Whether it's a unsuccessful resuscitation or someone like this guy, I think having that physician backup is critical. And we have to do the best we can. And in terms of the last point you talked about, where some number of minutes goes by and perhaps they have a spark of life, you know, if we did the best we can, and that's the way it turns out, we need to treat that when it happens. But I think this is one area where we're highly at risk, and it's one spot where I think medical direction is in making the final determination. It's a really good idea.
Okay. Do you think? Oh, sorry, Chris.
No, go ahead.
Do you think we should? And this is kind of a interesting concept, but should we bring into EMS or paramedic education death?
Absolutely.
You know, bring, you know, because we talk about saving lives. We really get into, you know, that whole thing of how to bring them up and being back to, with us. But we get into saying, okay, this is dead. This is how long it takes rigor mortis to set in. Here's the bodies. You know, and, you know, almost like a coroner's type, a mini coroner type course.
You know, I think that we do a couple things in EMS education very well, especially, and I'm talking, I'm going to go with paramedic education, because I think that that should be the hallmark of what we talk about. I think EMT, to a lesser extent, should have some of this, but it's really hard in a very short course to institute some of this. But one of my dear friends always says that we need to take care of the biopsychosocial, spiritual something, some other need I can't think of right now, because she's a nurse and she's touchy-feely that way. But and she says that that's really the hallmark of a really good provider that can take care of all those issues. So in EMS, I don't think that we prepare people very well to deal with those psychosocial issues that nursing students and doctors get all the time. You know, I learned how to tell somebody in a family that a patient died on the job. I didn't learn that from, you know, 500 hours of clinical rides. I didn't learn that any other time than going out there and telling the family. And that is a hard thing to do. And you need to know the right things to say and the wrong things to say. And, you know, early in my career, very early on, like when I was, before I was 18, I was volunteering with the service. And I remember one time I said something to a family that I really shouldn't have said. And, you know, I learned from that mistake, but it's detrimental to the family's healing process and everything else to say the wrong things. And we really need to be better at that education. And I wish that every paramedic not only had to have A&P and biochem and all these other educational requirements, but they should have at least 6 months or a semester of psychology so that they understand, and human development, so they understand what's going on mentally and psychologically with people, because we deal with that type of patient anyway. So why not be able to delve into those issues with a family and understand those issues when we're on scene treating a patient?
I agree with you 100% on that. You know, I brought this up, especially in continuing education courses and, you know, the various pediatric courses that we teach and such, and, you know, dealing with SIDS and dealing with certain, you know, arrest, you know, cardiac arrest situations, non-viable. And the one thing that everyone has always said to me is, well, we're not grief counselors. That's not our job. And it frustrates me because, you know, right along the lines you're talking about, you know, we're not just sticking people with needles, taking blood pressures and pushing drugs. You know, we've got to deal with the mental support, you know, as well. And, you know, I mean, you know, a very simple, you know, grief counseling, you know, very, you know, to get at least started is not all that difficult to do. And it makes, I mean, it's nothing going to be what a true grief counselor would do, but it makes a tremendous impact upon the family.
That's very true. Well, and you know that we don't do in paramedic education how to document things very well. We don't tell them how to drive, and we don't tell them how to talk to people and be and teach them about the real part of this job, which is connecting with them and being, you know, now don't get me wrong. I know that everything else we teach is very important, but we don't teach people how to connect with people on a more emotional level that we need to. And we need to remove ourselves and distance ourselves. I'm not saying that everybody, you need to get in and be all like, I'm touchy-feely, and I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that everybody should be a social worker, but we do have a lot of aspects of our job that are social work, and we really need to hone in on that and really be effective at that. And I really wish that there was a way in our educational requirements to tell paramedics, hey, you're going to be doing this a lot. In fact, you're probably going to be holding more hands than you are going to be pushing drugs. And you need to learn this. And you need to learn how to connect with people for 10 minutes, 30 minutes, however long you're in their life. You need to, because when you connect with that person, you find out so much more about them. And I think that that really goes to the fact that you can't treat somebody medically without learning everything else about them. And that's why I think it's important that people have primary care physicians and physicians that they spend, you know, cradle to grave with if you can, because a lot of the systems, the medical systems around the world have that model where the doctor knows you from the time you're born till the time you die, and you stay with that person as much as you can. And I think that that's something we miss in our society, because we have this idea of sick care, not health care. And that's part of it. So I'm sorry, I'm digressing really big because we're moving into healthcare reform and things like that. But so Gary and Kyle, am I hitting the nail on the head there with what we need to be doing? I mean, it's hard. It's just so hard for us to talk about this in 20 minutes or less because it's such a big subject.
I think you boil it down to one important thing that people that lead EMS organizations need to start insisting on. And that is that paramedic training be a degree.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's so nice. Gosh.
Absolutely.
Well, and it needs to be true. It needs to be considered a healthcare clinician, not a technician.
And I that's it. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
And that's absolutely. Our medical director for us has even told us directly, you're not technicians, you're clinicians, and that's how I expect you guys to perform.
Oh, that's so refreshing. And, but you know, why are we, have we been then dragged down by, and I'm going to talk about this idea in a minute, of Boise, Idaho trying to, their fire department's trying to decrease their response time to calls, which is absolutely insane. But is that, are we being dragged down as an industry because we have this, we have the need to churn paramedics through a system so that we can maintain a theoretical goal of 8 minutes and 59 seconds 90% of the time or less, and that's all that matters. Our industry is measured by the time it takes us to respond, not by the care that that patients get when we get there. Is that an accurate statement, do you think?
I think that's close to it, but I also think the thing is that EMS needs to be a career, not a stepping stone for other healthcare professions such as nursing.
So describe what you mean by that.
A lot of times you see people, they don't last in EMS. You know, there's a few of us that have gone on and have progressed, but there are many, many people that come in. They work up to paramedic and then they're off to something else, you know, whether it be nursing or PA school. And I mean, it's great if they feel that that's a stepping stone, but I've had people tell me over and over, I can't make a career out of EMS. Mm. I disagree with them. You know, there's more things. They generally only think of, you know, EMS as, you know, sitting in an ambulance, you know, and responding to calls, but it's much more than that. And I think, you know, this podcast is one example. The education that people create and bring out is more that. You've got schools such as University of Pittsburgh and University of Maryland and UCLA that are really trying to make, you know, baccalaureate degree programs, master's degree programs, even working on PhD programs in EMS.
Oh, you're speaking to the choir, man.
I know, that's the hard part.
It's so hard for me when people say, you know, and it's from one segment of our industry sometimes that is really pushing for better, faster, cheaper, and that's not what we want. We want better and nearly quicker, but I don't think it should be cheaper. I really don't. I don't think you can do. And Skip Kirk was always saying, "Hey, you can have those three, but you can only pick two." So, and I do agree with him to some point. So anyway, sorry, I digress. Any last thoughts on this subject? Mistaken CPR pronouncements. We kind of diverged really far from that, but I wish the crew well, and I hope that they can recover from that, because you know that can eat away at you too. I think that, you know, I think it's important as an EMS administrator that they ensure that those people get counseling to some degree, because it's like, crap, I missed that. I did something that, oh, there goes our iTunes clean tag. Oh well. But I did something that, you know, I may have caused more harm to a patient because I didn't treat him. Or so anyway, I think that it's important that they realize, recognize that, and get them some help too.
Sometimes bad things happen to good people.
And, right.
So I'm certainly not making a judgment about this crew. I think back recently to a case in St. Paul where an ambulance backed over a deaf woman in an alley. And I know the guy that was driving that ambulance, the fireman that was driving the ambulance, captain, and great guy. I worked with him for a number of years.
And Gary, you worked with him for a number of years.
Sometimes bad things. At the state fair, actually.
Okay.
But we do have to be vigilant, and this is one of those areas where we really need to be extra cautious.
Oh, that is, oh man, my heart goes out to him, because that can happen. The funny thing is, that could happen to anybody. You're right. And it's a hazard in our job, but we also, I think as long as we can recognize that, but it takes time to overcome things that happen like that. So, oh my goodness, my hat's off to him, because what we do is really take care of people, and we never want to hurt anybody, for sure. So, next subject, moving on. There's really no segue into this one, but I found it interesting. Texting your emergency to 911. I actually kind of laughed at the story when I first heard it. I'm like, that could be interesting. Have you guys ever heard of the textsinthenight.com? It's a website I found this week from somebody on Twitter. She sent me the link, and her name is Miss Paramedic, if you want to follow her on Twitter. And she said, if you go there, people will post texts that they received. It looks probably like a lot of drunk texts anyway. So I, in my mind, immediately flashed that website with the texting to 911 going, I wonder how many texts, 911 will get for pretty interesting things. But I think it could be useful in the long run. I just don't know. I guess I don't understand the technology behind it, how you text 911. But did you guys read that story from Iowa?
I did. It's interesting. I think, you know, I did a little bit of, you know, research, and there's a couple of articles that go back even a couple more years about text messaging, and they cite some of the similar aspects of someone breaks into your house and you run into the closet with your text, text on your phone to the call center. But the one thing they're looking at is GPS enabling of the phones and such for those. And I think the one thing is for the deaf community. I definitely see that aspect. You have a deaf or nonverbal community, they've got a call through a interpreting service or a relay service, I should say.
Oh, that's a great idea. I never even thought about it for them. That's really good. Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, I guess that can be useful.
Of course, and I don't know where it was. I was reading it somewhere about, people being kidnapped, thrown in the back of, back of a car, for those, and, having text 911 to get help faster. But I don't know how many of those are a year, so I don't know.
Yeah, I would think that it would be a low incidence, but I could see where it could be handy for that. I guess I often see that, the new laws that are coming out say you shouldn't text and drive, but now I see a lot of people going, honest officer, I was just texting 911 about that call or about that accident I saw a couple miles back when they get pulled over for texting while they're driving or something like that. I was texting 911 because I needed help. I don't know. It's just kind of funny. I had another thought on that texting 911, but Gary, are you aware of any other moves afoot in other jurisdictions around the country to make that happen?
I'm not. Our world has changed, and some of us thought we'd never be into texting, me included, but I do it all the time now, and access is what the public wants, and so I applaud Waterloo. I grew up about 60 miles from there, and I'm glad they're doing it. I hope that it doesn't get abused, because in the long run, it can be a good thing.
I completely agree. You said you grew up not far from there. You're from Iowa originally? Maybe I did know that. I think I did know that.
I spent my first 18 years there.
Oh, wow. Very nice. Near Davenport or no? Is that where Waterloo's at?
Waterloo's north and west of Davenport. I was born down by Omaha and grew up in the center of the state.
Oh, very nice. Well, very cool. Here's the next question. Do you think that maybe someday we'll be able to Twitter our emergency? There'll be like a Veil. So for us, it'd be Veil.com or Veil 911 Dispatch. You could Twitter your emergency to them.
I'm having chest pain. I'm short of breath now. Losing consciousness.
And you're like, and the dispatcher that was watching Twitter is now taking a break. Well, Gary, you're right, because I think texting is a very efficient method of communication. In fact, I'd prefer to do that over calling anybody any day of the week. So if you want to get a hold of me, just text me, because I really appreciate that. Because I figure if I can talk to you in 140 characters or less, I'm really happy. So.
But, that brings up a good point, though, because, we were just talking the other day about cell phones and 911 calls, and how sometimes cell phones are saviors when it comes to emergencies, but how sometimes that driver by that third party who happens to have a cell phone calling in for the multi-car accident, and it happens to be some guy changing a tire, on that. What's that going to do once we start text messaging? Is it going to be, people are more likely to choose to call in anything because they're just sending a text message as opposed to actually speaking with an operator?
It certainly is preferable to make the voice call, especially from a cell phone that has GPS capability. But as I thought about or read this story, I thought about something that happened to me last year. I had a problem with a filling, and it was Saturday, and the dental facility that was open is about 15 miles north of my house. So I went up to Big Lake, and Karen and the kids went off to my brother-in-law's, and wouldn't you know, a tornado came through Big Lake. Oh. And so we all got out of the dental chair and went to the basement, and I didn't have any cell phone. I didn't have any voice service on the cell phone, but I had data service. And I actually emailed Nick, who's not on with us tonight, and he made a phone call to my wife on her cell phone because she was sure to hear about the tornado on the news, and handled that problem that way, but there was no voice service, but I had data. So it would be best to get the GPS as well, but I can see areas where this would be a great service.
I was reading somewhere, I can't remember where it was online, that after Katrina hit, similar to you, is that there was no voice service, but there's lots of data service.
Well, it makes sense. Oh, go ahead.
That was true for us. We had units in downtown New Orleans for a couple of months after the hurricane, and we used Nextel modems. No cell phone service, but the modems functioned the entire time.
Wow, that's impressive. So, well, I guess it does make sense a little bit because data is so much more compact than voice. So it would make sense that you could punch a lot more data through a cell tower. The voice could go down way before the data could. And if the link for the data or the voice actually drops, you could still have data coming through there. So that's actually good to know. That's really good. Next topic I wanted to talk about tonight is the article that came out of Boise this week that I found pretty interesting. It actually lit up a pretty neat fire on the NEMSMA listserv. If you're not on NEMSMA, go to the Google groups, search NEMSMA, NEMSA, and join. It's absolutely free. Or if you really want to get the good benefits, Gary, how can they join NEMSMA?
They can do it online at NEMSMA.org.
There you go. Very good. Hey, it's not a commercial, but I really appreciate everything they do for our industry, so I like to give them a plug every now and then. So thanks, NEMSMA. So this topic came up on NEMSMA this week. Boise Fire wants to help shorten paramedic response times. So I have a hard time with this because everybody kind of knows my bent toward not necessarily thinking fire is the end-all be-all, but Ada County EMS is the county-run ambulance service that provides service to not only Boise, but the entire county. The fire department in Boise is saying that they want to help reduce the response times from what I could gather from reading all the information that I found, is that they're within 8 minutes and 59 seconds 90% of the time a lot. But the fire department wants to shorten this to like 6 minutes or 4 minutes. That just seems ridiculous in order to get a paramedic on scene that quickly. I guess I don't understand what their methodology is behind that. They want to buy some ambulances and put some paramedics on it. And really what they say is we would like to enhance the care in our community. And I hear that a lot, but I don't think that that's necessarily objective or the long view of what's going on. So do you guys have thoughts on that? I don't know. It stirs up so many emotions in me. I'm trying to be journalistic in this without injecting my opinion, which doesn't happen very often. So, thoughts?
I think when you start, I guess my question is why and what's their purpose, for doing that? I mean, they can all say, better service, but does it really bring better service? I think we talked a little bit last week about, that. Does response time make a difference for an ALS unit? AED, CPR, certainly. Is there other ways that can be offset? Here, where we work, we're actually a tiered system where all our police officers are actually AED trained, CPR trained, and first aid trained. For that, and the thing I would start to get worried is what kind of pressure is this going to put on to the providers to make those times? Are they going to start driving faster, more dangerously? If they don't make their times, are there going to be disciplinary actions that would cause that to happen?
That's a good question. Well, and you're right. I mean, if we're going to build a system and we're going to design it around people that die of sudden cardiac arrest, then AED and good CPR is really what they need in the first 4 minutes, 4 to 6 minutes. So design your system around a tiered response, not around providing more ALS care and more comfort to the people that you're serving. I guess I just don't understand how that really helps the greater good. What it does, in my view, is it dilutes the provider base and dilutes all the ALS calls. It dilutes the 911 system, and it doesn't necessarily make a stronger EMS system.
I agree. I definitely agree. We the system that I work in is actually a unique system in the area. We're part of the police department, and we're a ALS first response, and is a tiered system whereby, you know, the police respond. They generally respond emergency, and typically we're responding non-emergency unless it's something significant. And the ambulance responds non-emergency unless we need them there faster. But they get there, we get there, we follow them, care after that. We begin care, and if it needs an ALS transport, we'll actually hop on the ambulance because all the ambulances are BLS ambulances. And response time, you know, if you look at response time to somebody on scene, it's fantastic because, you know, they send the cars that are in the patrol area.
See, and if you're really going to design a system, they're the ones that should be the ones that are the quick response units. I mean, cops are everywhere. They, in fact, in one of the counties here in Colorado that it's adjacent to us, they have a community or a public access AED program, and they put AEDs in all the police cars. Well, they've seen more saves from the AEDs in the police cars than they ever saw from the ambulance or the fire department. And that's just because they're always, I mean, they're... their response times are so fast. Sometimes they're on scene within 2 minutes. And that, I mean, we cannot design an EMS system to make that happen. I think we'd be crazy to do that.
No.
For the very few patients that it would completely impact. But we can design an EMS system that is inclusive of all other types of responders. So I just thought it was a very interesting article because I really felt like it was a move to build an empire and to try and say, because in the article, the chief from the fire department says, we're helping Ada County EMS provide better service. But nowhere does he say how or what that service is going to be other than we're just going to make response times faster. Well, it just doesn't pass the smell test for me. But unfortunately, people listen to fire departments more than they listen to EMS. And that's just our own political battle to fight sometimes.
Yeah, come back in 5 years and see how they are financially. Right. The only way I can see them doing it is by adding more staff.
Well, yeah, and that's what they were saying in the article, too. And somebody wrote on the listserv, and I don't know if I should share this, but I'm going to. It's public, so you can get on there. Somebody wrote on the listserv, well, maybe they should cross-train all the paramedics on the ambulances to have bunker gear and carry a 10-pound extinguisher because they could be on scene quickly, too, to put out most of the fires. I was like, oh, gee, let's not start that argument. You know, I think that we could all live in one big happy world, and I think it's important. But you know, don't go under the guise that you want to increase response or decrease response times, because I don't think that it's good to fracture a good EMS system. Work with the people. You know, go, hey, can we provide more paramedics to help you in your units and put more people on your units? If that's the case, and the fire department wants to spend money to do that, great. I think that's a great idea. But don't work under this false guise of decreasing response times, because it never flies. At least it never flies for those of us in the industry that really understand it. So anyway, that's all I have to say on the subject. I don't know. Gary or Kyle, do you guys have any more thoughts on that?
I think what they need to look at, though, and we won't get into a discussion about, you know, one single term paramedic like we did last week with Rob, but, do you really need to have a paramedic on every single call? You know, and I think that's how the systems need to look at. You know, does this patient need to go ALS? You know, is their condition going to change in the next 5, 10, 15 minutes, you know, that they need a paramedic right with them? Or can you go ahead and, you know, save the paramedics for those calls where they would make a difference and send some of these patients in BLS units? So then it's cheaper to have many more to run systems with more EMTs and less paramedics, and that way you don't tie up your paramedics for those calls where they're not really going to make a difference.
Good point. We're actually struggling with that now, trying to look at different delivery models within our own system too. So, and as budgets get tighter, I think we've got to be flexible and at least willing to look at different models, because not everybody needs a paramedic, and I don't think we should try to color our lenses with rose colored or paramedic colored glasses that everybody does need a paramedic. So that's unfortunate, but time will tell. And I wish the people at Ada County and Boise fire all the best, because I hope that they can come to an agreement and really do what's right for patients out there. So, Kyle, we're coming to the end of the podcast, but where can we find you on any of the on like the social networking sites, or do you have a blog, or how can we find you?
I'm on Facebook under Image Medic.
Ooh.
I'm on EMS One, EMS United, and I have a webpage, which is KyleDavidBates.com.
KyleDavidBates.com. K-Y-L-E. I'm typing it now so I can remember to put it on the... I'll put it in the show notes. And what do you do? What do you do at KyleDavidBates.com?
My background is not only EMS, but education and graphic design. So I do a lot of custom curricula design those. I also do a lot of photography and graphic work for various EMS programs that are out there for online and for distribution.
Did you design your own logo on your website?
I did.
Oh, I love that. That's great.
Thank you.
I may have to contact you to do some design work for me. That's great.
Absolutely.
That's really good. Well, thanks, Kyle. Thanks for joining us. Gary, how about you? Where can we find you? Are you on, I know you're on everything, but where's the easiest way people can find you?
Yeah, I'm on all of those sites, but I'm not good at doing updates. So the best way to get me is by email.
I know. We need to Twitter you. We need to get you on Twitter. And then
I'm on it.
But we need to link you to everything else. It does.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Will you tweet? You're right. I can't say it. It sounds so bad. It's funny. Well, so email. How can people get a hold of you? Do you want to give out your email?
You can link it on the webpage if you want.
Okay, I'll do that. So go to our webpage, emsgarage.com, and look for Gary's email address. Look for Kyle's webpage and find him on Facebook and all those great places. You can find me pretty much anywhere, Geeky Medic, on all of the different sites, and Twitter and Facebook. And if you just Google that, you'll find a lot of stuff. So it's a lot of fun. Thank you guys for joining us. Join us next week when we talk more about EMS news that's really important to you. And Buck. I don't know why I can't think of Buck's name right now. Buck's been so busy, poor guy. But him and I have this idea that we should call it This Week in EMS. But he owns the website for that, so maybe someday we'll do that. But right now it's EMS Garage. And join us next week when we talk more about issues that are related to you.